Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today we take you to the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations in Northport for a talk by David Stoll, who is a professor of anthropology at Middlebury College in Vermont. The title of today's talk is Migration from Guatemala to the U.S. David Stoll has worked with indigenous communities in Guatemala since the 1980s. He has written several books on his research and has written about Central American migration for the Wall Street Journal, Miami Herald, and the American Interest. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is George Look, president of the Mid-Coast Forum.
Welcome to the 429th meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Northport, Maine. I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 as a citizens' forum for study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies and of the factors influencing them. We are now in our 36th year of monthly meetings, featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. Details about and audios of past forum talks, upcoming forum programs, and how to become a forum member are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today we are very pleased to have with us Professor David Stoll, who will be speaking on migration from Guatemala to the United States. Professor David Stoll has worked with indigenous communities in Guatemala since the 1980s and has taught at Middlebury College in Vermont for the past 22 years. In his book, El Norte or Bust, How Migration, Fever, and Microcredit Produced a Financial Crash in a Latin American Town, published in 2012, he describes how migration actually impoverishes many rural Guatemalans because they take on unmanageable debt to finance the trip north. He has written about Central American migration for the Wall Street Journal, the Miami Herald, and the American Interest. His earlier books included Is Latin America Turning Protestant?, published by the University of California Press in 1991, Between Two Armies in the Ixtal Towns of Guatemala, published by the Columbia University Press in 1993, and Rigoberta Menchú and the Story of All Poor Guatemalans, published by the Westview Press in 2007. Dr. Stoll received his bachelor's degree in anthropology from the University of Michigan and his PhD from Stanford University. David, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thank you, George. Thanks to the Mid-Coast Forum, and thanks in particular to my friend and fellow anthropologist, Rob Wasserstrom, who's the person who had the idea of inviting me here. One of our most treasured commitments as a liberal democracy is the right to asylum. Many Americans like the idea that anybody can show up at our borders and seek refuge from persecution. But who actually deserves that kind of protection, and what to do when large groups of people ask for it en masse, that's never been an easy question. 80 years ago in 1939, European Jews fleeing Nazi Germany were one such group. Now we have another group consisting of Central Americans. Judging from figures released by the Department of Homeland Security, from October 2018 to May 2019, DHS detained 1.27% of the entire population of Guatemala. And during that same eight-month period, DHS detained 1.77% of the entire population of Honduras. All told, DHS arrested 430,000 migrants from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador 84% of these detainees were either family units or unaccompanied minors. It would appear that most of these people are applying for asylum, although try as hard as I cannot find a DHS report giving us precise figures on asylum applicants. Today, I'm not going to go into the legislative and judicial reasons that at the moment have made it relatively easy for Central Americans to apply for asylum. Instead, I'm going to tell you about a particular town in Guatemala that is contributing to this flow. Most of the people I'll be telling you about are either Ishil Mayas or Quiche Mayas. That is, they're indigenous and they speak Spanish as their second language. Most of these folks have never heard of Maine or Vermont, but Los Angeles, Phoenix, Houston, Miami, Maryland, Virginia, they all shine brightly. The US that they visualize is framed by tall buildings and beaches. The US they visualize buzzes with shoppers and sports cars and criminals and cops and computer-enhanced spectacles. That's the fantasy world that they see on their devices. What's not fantasy is how they visualize the purchasing power of the American dollar. The dollar is much stronger than our own currency, they say. They know that if they can somehow get to the US and work for dollars, they know that the dollars produced by that day's labor will buy a lot more than if they stay at home. Guatemala's in the global south, so this is a country that usually gets into US media only when there's a catastrophe. But Guatemala is not a catastrophe in two important ways. Number one, a peace agreement ended four decades of civil war in 1996. Both sides, the Guatemalan army and their Marxist guerrilla opponents, they both stopped fighting. Political killing is now a small fraction of what it used to be. Second, capitalism is alive and well in Guatemala in the sense of multiplying the total amount of wealth. Shopping centers now ring the capital. The Pan-American Highway is clogged with stop and start traffic. Most Guatemalans have more access to healthcare, schooling, and consumer durables than their parents did. What's not working is that the political system has no capacity to regulate or distribute the wealth produced by capitalism. Of the last six presidents, all but one of them have been indicted for corruption. Two are currently behind bars. The ownership of resources is so skewed that most benefits of economic growth flow to a small upper class. The majority of Guatemalans are still scraping by on less than minimum wage. Worse, Guatemalans are more aware than ever of what they're missing because even low-income people are somehow able to acquire smartphones. So at the level of recovering from a civil war, Guatemala is a success, but it's a success generating enormous amounts of relative deprivation and frustration. So now let's see what this combination of success and failure looks like in one of the Guatemalan municipios or counties that is sending us migration streams. The municipio of Nabac is in the Western Highlands. In 2018, it had a projected population of 106,000, but the well-run local health department could find only 78,000. What happened to a 26% shortfall of 28,000 people? Half or more of these people could easily be in the United States. Nabahenses themselves are astonished at how many of their number have gone north. It's been my good fortune to visit Nabac every year, almost every year since the 1980s. These are the people who helped me do my doctoral dissertation. These are the people who helped me evaluate the peace process. These are the people who have given me a window onto the debt structure that sends Central Americans to the US. Most of the people you see at the US border in media footage have borrowed lots and lots of money to get that far. Once all the debt is taken into account, it calls into question our usual assumption that migration to the US is a net benefit for migrants and their families. 11 years ago, many Nebuchadnezzars informed me that they were borrowing several times their annual income to pay coyotes to smuggle them to the US. The loans were from microcredits, from loan sharks, from savings and loans, and from banks. And the borrowers were groaning under the debts they had contracted. I met families whose coyote investments had gone so wrong that on a household income of $2,000 or $3,000 a year, they owed more than $25,000. And the worst cases were double or triple that. The figures were jaw-dropping. And yet this during the same period, other families were so successful that their remittances turned Nabok into a migratory boomtown, which it remains to this day. Here's a photo of the pastoral Nabok of 30 years ago, circa 1987. And here's what that same road looks like now. For the radio audience, cornfields have turned into 3 and 4 stories of cement block. That's the new migratory boomtown, Nabok. A lot of this new construction is financed by remittances sent home by migrants. But there are also many losers, and you don't realize that until you slow down and start asking questions. Going north usually requires putting up family land as collateral. Not all migrants find enough work to pay back their loans, or they get caught by US border enforcement. And in either case, they're going into default and the debt swallows their collateral. Here's Sebastian and his family standing in front of what used to be their house. It's no longer their house because it was seized by a moneylender for non-payment of a loan. The first thing the moneylender did was pull down the house so that the family could not reoccupy it. Investing in migration to the US has been so speculative and so risky that Nabok actually had its own financial crash in 2007, 10 months before our most famous crash on Wall Street. You might ask, now why would Nebuchadnezzars make such risky investments in migration? Are they desperate for some reason? Are they desperate to come north? Well, you might ask, are they running away from street gangs? Nebuchadnezzars, in this local situation, are not running away from gangs because there are no gangs in Nabok. In fact, the surrounding department has one of the lowest homicide rates in Guatemala. Could they be fleeing the consequences of the civil war? It's true that Nabok was hit so hard by the war that many of the witnesses against an ex-army dictator in a 2013 trial for genocide, majority of those witnesses were from Nabok. That's how hard Nabok was hit. And yet since then, it's become a magnet for a relief and development programs. And 60% of the current population actually has been born since the war ended. So I think it's easy to exaggerate the role of the war in setting all this up. The most obvious reason for the rush north is that over the last 40 years, the population has more than doubled. In a trend that began before the war, in a trend that began a long time before the war, Nabok parents have continued to produce 5, 6, 7, even more children, even though they have not inherited enough land for their traditional livelihood as peasant farmers. And so this is a very, very frustrating place to be 20 years old. Any male can earn $7 or $8 a day as a day laborer, but this is only enough for bare necessities. Worse, remittances have hyperinflated the cost of local real estate. To pay the staggering prices for even a tiny house lot, every family that's producing lots of children that needs additional houses in the next generation, they're under pressure to send somebody north. Only in the US can a family with an income of $2,000 or $3,000 a year earn the $10,000 or more that is necessary just to buy a small house lot in a village. Now, until recently, most migrants were males between the ages of 15 and 25. Now a rising percentage are female. Getting into the US has become so easy that human smugglers now charge two very different prices for two very different kinds of trip. The higher price is for the old-fashioned approach in which guides sneak you past US border enforcement and deliver you to your relatives in a metro area such as Washington, DC. In 2008, this kind of trip cost $5,000 or $6,000 per person. Now the price has doubled to $12,000 or more for that old-fashioned evade enforcement kind of trip. The new kind of trip is called entrega a la frontera, or delivery to the border. Your coyote takes you to the Rio Grande. He sends you across on an inner tube, and he points you to the nearest Border Patrol agent. You walk up to the agent, you say you're afraid to go home, and you ask for asylum. The price for this kind of trip is a mere $3,000 to $4,000 per person. Here is a coyote business card that was being handed out in Nabok this last March. To translate for the radio audience, we see in big letters at the top, trips to the United States, we take men, women, and children. Then in lowercase, quote, totally financed until you reach your destination. Border of Cananea, Coahuila, Nuevo Progreso, Mexico. Fixed price, 6 days to cross all of Mexico on a bus, sufficient food, secure and guaranteed travel. Through the desert, there's a short route, which would be more expensive. And then there's a longer route, which will be more expensive. That's a coyote business card, and not the only one I've seen. So, in effect, Nabahenses are now borrowing money to deliver themselves to the Department of Homeland Security. Some have informed me that my country now has a permiso, or special program, for women and children, such that if you're a woman or child, you just show up at the border and the U.S. will accept you. Some Nabahenses are scratching their heads over why, if President Trump is so against immigrants, he's accepting even more of them than President Obama did. One man's explanation for this conundrum was, the U.S. is a nation of old people, Guatemala is a nation of young people, and the U.S. maybe needs Guatemalans to fight its next war in the Middle East. On my last visit in June, the people I talked to seemed to believe that this new approach to migration was functioning smoothly. If all goes well, within a few days or weeks, migrants are released to their relatives and they're free to look for a U.S. job, but it doesn't always go well. So now I'm going to tell you the first of six stories that'll help you understand what can go wrong. Here's the first story. In 2016, an Ashiel farmer borrows $3,000 to send his 16-year-old son north. The low price indicates delivery to the border, in which the son's status as a minor is going to get him released to a relative, freeing him up to look for a job and pay back the meager loan and support his parents on that mountainside in Guatemala. 16-year-old Miguel, and this is a pseudonym, 16-year-old Miguel is soon in the custody of the U.S. government, which soon releases him to his stateside relative. Here's what went wrong, according to Miguel's father. First, the terms of release require Miguel to go to school, where he gets into trouble for touching the breast of a fellow student. Second problem, his sponsor offers him beers to drink. Third problem, because of his legal obligation to go to school, he can only work one day a week. Fourth problem, his sponsor demands that he contribute his wages to the rent of the apartment where they're living, rather than send the money home to his dad, with the result that poor dad has to sell the land against which he borrowed the money to pay off the smuggling debt. So here's a family selling off its agricultural land to put a 16-year-old into the U.S. labor market. Now for a second story. Julia was also 16 years old when she went north and was delivered to DHS in May 2018. The plan was quick release to a girlfriend who was already in the U.S. and who would be her sponsor. But Julia screwed up her intake interview by admitting she wanted to earn money to support her family back home, nor did DHS buy the argument that her 20-year-old buddy, who had also arrived as an underage minor, would make sure that she went to school. So 4 months later, Julia was still locked up in a shelter for unaccompanied girls, sobbing with frustration. Through a nonprofit in Nabok, Alejandra's father telephoned me from Guatemala in the hope that I could get her out of protective custody. Here's what Dad told me. Quote, "I'm just a poor man and do not have the resources to send my daughter to school. That's why my daughter went to the U.S. to look for her future, buscar su futuro in Spanish, to look for her future and obtain an education. I beg you to speak with the social worker. Maybe there is a social organization, that is an NGO, that can get me out of this jam." That's what the father told me. Notice that while Julia's father says he cannot afford to send his daughter to school in Nabok, that's maybe $500 a year, he can afford to borrow several times that amount to send her to the U.S. because he thinks she's going to find a job and become an income source. The only thing I could do was ring up the social worker who told me she was not finding enough guardians for all the girls like Julia. So many girls have arrived that they've overwhelmed the placement system. So until Julia can wiggle out of that shelter and into some kind of a job, all her parents' cash flow is going to be sucked up by the interest on her loan. That's why her father was so desperate. Now, according to asylum advocates, many of the Central Americans reaching the U.S. border are refugees for one reason or another. Thus, when the U.S. government impedes their entry into the U.S., it violates the human rights. And so, according to asylum advocates, immigrants become victims of the U.S. government. But when I take this paradigm to Nabok and this simplistic victim-victimizer dichotomy, it just doesn't hold up in identifying all the different winners and losers that migration creates. To illustrate that point, here's a third case. The 18-year-old Anna did not go north as the result of a plan with her parents. They wanted her to stay home and, as the oldest sibling, help them support the younger siblings. But Anna escaped her parents by going north with a loan from a stateside boyfriend. Since joining the boyfriend, her financial obligations plus two pregnancies have prevented her from sending her parents money. And so the last time I talked to Anna's mother in Guatemala, here's what the mother had to say, quote, "I didn't give her schooling so she would go to the U.S. and produce children. We gave her schooling and now we owe a lot of money for her. I give my children their schooling, but they don't help me. I give them their schooling so they'll get me out of poverty, but instead they look for a husband. We spent a lot to give Anna her schooling. She went to the U.S., now she has two children. She left behind lots of work. I gave my other daughter, Juana, her schooling, and now she's gone off with her husband. They're producing more children, and we remain behind in debt. All I can do is ask God to help me." That's the word from Anna's mother. So the idea that your teenagers will go to the U.S. and send you money, it often fails to work out. Now, with the help of U.S. court orders and smuggling networks, Nebahenses have now worked out another approach. It's a little more sophisticated than just sending your teenager north. And as far as I could tell, based on my last visit in June, this one seemed to be functioning smoothly. This is to send up two people at the same time, a parent plus a child under the age of 18. If the parent is male, he says he's fleeing persecution of some kind. If the parent is female and seeking to join her stateside husband, she says the same thing. But if she's leaving her husband behind, she says she is fleeing domestic abuse. Why domestic abuse? How could that get you into the United States? In 2014, the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is the highest U.S. immigration court, ruled that a Guatemalan woman could qualify for asylum on grounds of life-threatening abuse by her husband back in Guatemala. 4 years later, that was the Aminta Cifuentes case. 4 years later, as part of the Trump offensive against the growing number of asylum claims, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions barred domestic violence as grounds for asylum. How many asylum cases actually have been filed on these grounds, I cannot tell you. But I do know that some Nabok women have paid smugglers to take them north so that they can ask for protection from their allegedly life-threatening husbands. So our fourth story comes from a friend who is a successful Nabok businessman. According to my friend, his daughter Elena married a good man who went to the U.S. to earn money. Unfortunately, this good husband came home addicted to drugs. So Elena, at the age of 28, has taken two children under the age of 9 to the U.S. in order to, in her father's words, look for her future. Because of the two small children, DHS soon released Elena with an ankle monitor to friends in a Midwestern state, but the location was too rural for her, so now she has moved to a low-income neighborhood in a major U.S. city. She doesn't have legal permission to work, but with her two children now in school or daycare, she's found a job anyway. Thus far, her father has spent $11,000 on her smuggling and legal fees. Now then, if Elena really did have a violent spouse, would she be safer in the U.S.? I don't think so. Nabok has had a women's movement for decades. There's a women's shelter for abused women. The town is full of churches and NGOs that program support for women. The town hall has an office for women. And there are two different police forces that both employ female cops. Now, by way of contrast, what are Elena's potential sources of support in a low-income U.S. neighborhood? Would anybody in this room send a Central American mother without English but two small children to live in a low-income neighborhood anywhere in the U.S. That in this particular case, judging from the city, it probably does have a gang problem? In that big city, the economics of single motherhood is quickly going to pressure Elena into a second marriage that is probably going to be disadvantageous, and it's also going to pressure her into further pregnancies, which will add to the disadvantage. She's not going to have any blood relatives to protect her. So I just wonder how well this is going to work out. Now let me now underline an important difference between this case and our first three cases. The first three cases were about eager to work teenagers. If you're 15 years old, you're working age in Central America. Elena and her father, in contrast, are using small children as a border entry strategy. This is becoming very common. For example, I have another friend, an evangelical pastor, who got sucked into this kind of scheme. And so this fifth story, actually his story that I'm borrowing from him, begins with three children, aged 10, 6, and 3, who each have a father who used them to get into the U.S. last year. The three dads and the three kids probably traveled together across Mexico. They probably presented themselves together to border agents, and they got into the U.S. without a hitch, except for one problem. The three fathers have to work long hours to pay for this trip. But DHS requires them to put their small children in school. The schools are public and free, but the dads found that getting the kids to these schools every morning was expensive. And then after school, they're still working. Who's going to take care of a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, the 10-year-old? So the three fathers go to the nearest Guatemalan consulate, which is willing to provide documentation to send the kids home. But there's another problem. They need an adult to accompany the kids on the plane, which is where my pastor friend comes in. He has a tourism visa for church visits to the U.S. So the fathers paid for the pastor's plane ticket, as well as the tickets for the three children. They got home. But my pastor friend says he was puzzled by the thinking of the three fathers. "Are you really sure you want to send your kids back to Guatemala?" he asked them. "If it was me," he told them, and he told me, "I would want my kid to study in the U.S. Because everything in the U.S. is a little better. The school is better, the house is better, the food is better, the clothing better." The father said no, because without women, they were unable to take care of their kids. The children were crying for their mothers. The mothers were crying for their children. So the pastor brought the three kids back this last March. Since then, he's been asked to bring back more children. He has said no, but we can be sure that for someone, bringing back border entry children is becoming it's a lucrative business. So some Nebuhadnezzars are very distressed about parents using their children in this way, but they're physically afraid of the coyotes, and town authorities have no interest in getting in the way of what is now Nabok's principal industry, which is sending its youth to the U.S. Labor migration has often been a tough, mean business. What are the chances that Nebuhadnezzars will achieve successful lives in the U.S.? Here's a sixth and final story that's come my way. It begins with an unaccompanied minor who's sent north to work for her parents. Maria is under 18, so DHS accepts her right away into protective custody. But then it won't release her because they can't find a sponsor. The solution is to send up Maria's older sister, who's an adult, and who brings her baby. And so the adult and the baby win quick release, and then the older sister can then become the sponsor for her younger sister. Next, the husband shows up with their other child, another family arrangement here, and so very soon, without much trouble, probably for a cost of a mere $3,000 apiece, but then that adds up for an entire family group, we now have a family work team consisting of a married couple, an adolescent sister, and two small children. DHS wants the adolescent to be in school. Both parents need to work, so taking care of two small children, that is a problem. But what really goes wrong is that when the wife earns more than her husband, he suspects that the reason is that she is having sex with her boss. And so he hits her, supposedly in front of U.S. cops, and gets hauled away for domestic violence, leaving the mother to support this show on her own. So that's the kind of story I'm hearing about in Guatemala town, admittedly with an emphasis on bad news stories. The more complicated schemes include tourism visas, pregnancies, illnesses, relatives going up in relays to sponsor each other's kids. Something is always going wrong. The next departure is always being planned. Some days I hear the updates coming in over the cellular phone. What I've heard may not represent the entire spectrum of Central Americans coming to the U.S., but it does illustrate themes that come up elsewhere in other reporting and scholarship. Number one, most migrants who show up at the U.S. border have borrowed large sums of money to get there. The second point, the resulting debts have serious repercussions for their families. Third point, remittances are no panacea for low-income Central Americans because what works for some families becomes a disaster of lost patrimony for others. Fourth point, however bad the situation the Central Americans left behind, you should not assume that how they end up in the United States is necessarily better. Fifth point, this is a point that I'm not reiterating, but I'll just now make. I argue that legal status alone is not going to change this because the underlying problem is surplus labor, and even in the U.S., the wages that Central Americans receive are usually not high enough to pay for the cost of living. We can be sure that legal status alone is not the problem here because we know that millions of U.S. citizens have legal status. They're working full-time, and yet they live deep in poverty. As President Obama said, quote, nobody who works full-time should have to live in poverty, unquote. But many Americans do, and that's why the U.S. is not the solution for Central Americans that so many of us assume. Why would we assume that Central Americans, that the U.S. economy can solve poverty of Central Americans? The simple answer is we're blinded by dollars. Why are dollars so illusory? Explanation of why dollars are illusory. A dollar has tremendous purchasing power when it is taken back to Guatemala. A migrant earning $60 a day in the United States is earning 8 times what he could back home. As long as he's sending those dollars to Guatemala, he's increasing his purchasing power by 8, and he's vaulting into the middle class in Guatemala. But if he stays in the U.S. long enough to start a new family, or if he brings up his family, those $60 or even $100 a day are far below the U.S. cost of living. So once a migrant's frame of reference shifts from Guatemala to the U.S., he's back in poverty. The dollars that were worth so much in his own country lose most of their value once he decides to make his life in the United States. So I'll end there and thank you for your attention.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features David Stoll addressing migration from Guatemala to the U.S. He will now answer questions from the audience.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's always very nice to have be able to put a personal face on things and stories that are not just speculative, but are real stories on it. We're going to be gathering questions from our members here. And I always ask the first question myself, just to get things rolling. Aren't the Guatemalans learning something from this experience? I mean, you'd think that the number of people going back, the number of hard luck stories, there are a few success, but most of them aren't. I mean, why isn't there a learning curve here?
There is a learning curve, and there are Nebahenses who have, with a lot of thought, decided they are not going north, they're not sending their kids north. But bad news from the United States is often undermined by suspicion about the motives of whoever's transmitting the bad news. So let's say that I'm a 15-year-old in Nabok, and I'm eager to join my 20-year-old older brother in the suburbs of Baltimore. Because he's been sending back remittance checks, and you know what that money can buy, at least temporarily, the months they come, is really impressive. And so my older brother in Baltimore says, you know, Miguel, do not come. It's really bad here. I'm afraid of getting arrested. I'm treated badly by my boss. You have no idea how much I'm suffering to make this money. I might decide not to believe my older brother because he always had it in for me and he was always trying to keep me down. So even when bad news gets transmitted, it's often disbelieved. And then there are other migrants who fail to transmit the bad news because they borrowed from their family network to get there. And they went off with high hopes and they fear that if they communicate just how badly they're doing, they themselves will be blamed for the failure. Oh, he's gone back to drinking. Or he always was a lazy bones. So Nebahenses now have a lot of folklore from the United States. They're full of stories. It's not all disaster stories, and there always are success stories. I haven't told you any success stories, but there are families that appear to have pulled this off without being sunk by debt.
I don't know if this is a more general question, but can you sketch the comparison and compare and contrast the cases that you're talking about and the situation here with similar ones of migrations to the U.S. in the past? And this particular question was about the 1939 Jewish migration from the U.S. Europe to the U.S.
Well, Jews fleeing Europe who either did or did not get into the United States were coming into, I think, a rather different situation structurally than Guatemalans would be today. I think worst case scenario, in 1939, they could go to work in a defense plant. And the pay was not good by 2019 standards. And where they were living was not good by 2019 standards. But they would have been part of a ethnic enclave, and they would have had, now in hindsight, not thinking about this as it might have looked in 1939, but sort of looking back on a success story, they were able to obtain continuous employment, and they were able to take advantage of the post-war expansion of higher education. And so if we could track 1939 refugees who did get here, we would find that in the space of two or three generations, they were sufficiently successful to be with us in this room. The New York Times did a really interesting series about 10 years ago. I'm sorry I can't give you the date, but it made a big impression on me just as I was getting into this subject. It did very close-in, long-form journalism on a Greek restaurant owner somewhere in Manhattan and his either Guatemalan or Mexican labor. And the neat thing about the story was is that it set up a parallel between terms of arrival for that Greek migrant probably in the late 40s or early 50s, and the terms of arrival for that probably Mexican immigrant probably in the mid-90s. And it was then able to chart the ascent of the Greek restaurant owner to owning a restaurant, first generation success story, and then the obvious failure of his Guatemalan hired help, excuse me, his Mexican hired help to follow that same arc. And the thrust of the story was that at the 20-year mark, you know, Alex from Greece was a junior partner in a restaurant, and at the 20-year mark, Miguel from Mexico is still washing dishes. So there's quite a difference in the structure of the economy and what it enables immigrants to do. Both equally hardworking, and yet opportunities can vary tremendously from generation to generation.
And there's two sides. I'm going to ask two questions, one after another. I'll let you answer the first one first, but because there are several questions related to this. And that is, here's the simplest one on one side of this equation. What does or can the Guatemalan government do about this? Are they doing anything?
Central American governments are not going to do much about this because sending their youth to the United States is now the far and away the principal industry of all these countries. If you tot up all the export earnings of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, what do they get from producing, you know, coffee, bananas, textiles, electronic parts? What do they get from producing all that for the world market? What do they get from remittances? Those two figures are about the same. So when I looked up Guatemala recently, Guatemala was getting on the order of $9 billion a year in remittances. And its total export earnings from all other products were, I think, $9.4 or $9.6 billion. So I would expect no action from these governments except in response to what we hope is intelligent pressure from the United States government for changes that serve the interests not just of the United States, but also of low-income Central Americans.
On the other side of that equation, of course, is what can the U.S. be doing to help this problem? If there were an increase, for example, in the U.S. foreign aid to Guatemala, what would it be used for and what would be the impact?
There are two things that have been done in the past that we really need to do more of. And this is, I'm really talking about the status quo in U.S. foreign policy up until the Trump administration. The United States, since the 1990s, has poured significant amounts of money into what we would call policing and accountability reform. And that has paid off. Those six presidents indicted for corruption, you can look on that as a disgrace if you want, but it's also a commendation, you know, of all the Guatemalans who, you know, want honest government. And so progress has been made in accountability in Guatemalan government with the help not just of the U.S. but also the European Union. We can say the same thing for police reform. Central American homicide rates are still very high, but the homicide rate in Guatemala is now half of what it used to be. It used to be up to 45 per 100,000. Now it's down to 24 per 100,000. So policing reform actually has been working, and that creates a more stable environment for what is now a third thing that needs to happen. And again, it's something we've done before. We just need to do more of it. And that is trade and investment preferences for circum-Caribbean economies at the expense of investment and trade preferences for dictatorships. A basic criteria for trade and investment preference should be, is this or is this not a competitive electoral system in which the people out of power can replace the people who are in power? And if that's the case, you have a democracy, however turbulent or unsatisfactory it may be, and you have an atmosphere in which workers are able to organize for their rights. That ought to be the fundamental criterion for investment and job creation and trade preferences. And most of Central America meets that criteria, possibly not Honduras, but El Salvador and Guatemala certainly do.
So I'll stick with a moment here on what the U.S. can do. Here's a question. Obviously, we are not publicizing the truth about opportunities in the U.S. Why shouldn't we invest more in publicizing the problems that arise when the Guatemalans come here?
Oh, I think that, I guess the question here is we. The Trump administration is, at the top of its voice. And the trouble is that the Trump administration does not have credibility with, many American voters. But what the U.S. government has to say about the subject is not going to make much of an impression on the kinds of people whose stories I've been telling you. We've heard about all these terrible things that Trump has done to migrants over the last couple of years. I hear echoes of that reporting in what Nebuchadnezzar's tell me, but it's not a major theme. They're more impressed by the number of people who are getting through than on how hostile Trump is to immigrants. I mean, they sort of wonder, are these anti-immigrant tirades, are these some kind of a political joke? They actually have conspiracy theories to explain why Trump really isn't against immigrants. So what the U.S. government has to say does not make much of an impression on these people. What's really more critical is what the coyotes tell them and what their family members tell them.
And then one final kind of cooperation between the U.S. and Guatemala. The Trump administration announced last week a deal with Guatemala to hold migrants in country. The details are vague. Can this program work? Do you know any of the details?
I don't know the details. What I've picked up from the Washington Post and the New York Times and other sources, of course, is that the U.S. government is attempting to reclassify Mexico, Guatemala, and El Salvador as what is called safe third haven countries, which then allows the United States to reject even an asylum application from anybody who has come through those countries and says they're running away from political persecution or violence. Now, none of those three countries really meet the proper definition of a safe third haven, but I guess my rejoinder to the general problem of what do we do about all these asylum seekers? If you want to help Hondurans whose lives are actually endangered by alliances between violent gangs and corrupt cops, such that they can't even go to the cops for protection, if you really want to help them, you have to create a safe haven for them that does not involve borrowing money to pay another gang of smugglers, another gang, maybe the same gang, another gang, to go, 1,500 miles through another country to show up at the US border. There's a tremendous gang problem along the US border. So if you want to help Hondurans who actually have that problem, you have to create a safe haven much closer to Honduras. And I would recommend that the US and the European Union work with Central American governments to set up safe haven camps, you know, either within the territory of Honduras or right over the border in Guatemala, which have got, you know, international, at least some international supervision and safety for anybody who says that there's a problem. And then you would probably have to hook it up with some kind of an ombudsman procedure to take the case back to the locality that they fled in order to prosecute actual gang cop corruption that has forced them to leave their neighborhood. That's international involvement in anti-corruption measures. And there's actually already a very successful case of that in Guatemala. There's an international ombudsman prosecutor working through national attorney general. It worked very well in Guatemala for about 10 years. So if there are significant numbers of people who actually are approaching the US border with this actual problem, this is how you help them. Not by defending their right to hire another gang, to smuggle them into another gang zone, get into the US, and then probably go settle in a low-income neighborhood in the US which has a gang problem.
So then isn't asylum in Mexico worth something? That's another of these solutions.
Asylum in Mexico would definitely be a solution for some people. We would have to get down to what exactly they were running away from, and we would have to get down to the quality of the program. But the Mexicans are certainly capable of running a decent asylum program. Mexico is a major country. Mexico has a full political spectrum. Mexico has reformers. Mexico has a human rights movement. Mexico is aware that all human rights problems in Mexico are not the fault of the United States. So certainly, I think that an asylum program in Mexico is not a solution for 400,000 Central Americans a year. There's really no solution for 2% of the population of Honduras moving north. But for people with strong cases, certainly there would be. And there, you know, there should be asylum in the U.S. But the current procedure, just showing up at the U.S. border with a kid, that's completely unworkable as an asylum procedure. And it's an invitation to human trafficking. Because if it's possible for anybody to show up at the U.S. border with a kid, here you have to let me in, we know that every lowlife in the world, you know, who wants to get into the United States will be buying or renting a kid to get them in.
Well, then isn't the U.S. Border Patrol and the U.S. Immigration Courts, haven't they caught on to these tactics? I mean, is this...
Oh, I believe they have, and they're telling something to the Trump administration, and then the Trump administration and its policy, its policy-creating vehicles are, you know, spitting out the policies that we see reported in the press. I don't have a whole lot of confidence in the Trump administrative process, but just as a, you know, sort of a general reaction to this problem, I do think that if the Democrats had won in 2016, this whole problem would have developed without Trump, and the Democrats would be under serious pressure to take parallel measures. Hopefully, they would have done it better than the Trump administration. But the problem was not created by Donald Trump.
Well, we have a number of people who ask questions related to a longer-term solution, and that is, what's the role of birth control here? If, as you say, the cause of immigration is the burgeoning population, you know, where does the church stand on this? Is there any are there any measures in country, et cetera?
I grew up as a Catholic, and I am very pleased to tell you that as far as I know, the Catholic Church in Guatemala is not getting in the way of family planning. It just never, this never walks up to me and says hello. I just think that they've taken a calculated decision to keep their mouth shut. And so for some years now, every woman who gives birth in the Guatemalan government hospital. They get a post-birth family planning talk from a nurse speaking their own language, Ishiel Quiche, Canjobal, or Spanish. And family planning is explained to them, particularly in the form of birth spacing, spacing out births. And I am told, the last time I visited the maternity ward, I'm told that Depo Povera was the most popular technique. They really liked the idea of an implant that they could remove whenever they wanted to have another kid. So there are a lot of people working on family planning. The people I'm telling you about are, you know, Highland peasants, and they would be holdouts. The message would be the last to reach these folks. Other segments of the Guatemalan population, I see figures indicating that the Guatemalans are now down to an average of 3 or 3.5 per woman. But that's certainly not the case in the corner of Guatemala that I've been telling you about.
Well, we have a number of more very interesting questions, but I think we'll quit here. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Very interesting.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was David Stoll, a professor of anthropology at Middlebury College in Vermont. He recently spoke with the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations on migration from Guatemala to the U.S. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.